Excuse me. May it please the court. My name is Mark Evans, number 40156. I'm a public defender, and I'm here today representing Mr. Gabriel Almanza. As this court noted, the narrow question before the court today is how the Colorado Supreme Court's holding in People v. Brown should be applied to Mr. Almanza's request for a continuance so that he could obtain his counsel of choice. The Brown decision makes clear that if the record on appeal is not sufficiently developed for this court to evaluate at least 10 different factors, a remand is required. Here, the record on appeal is even less well developed than it was in Brown, so a remand is required here as well. Because this seems to be a very straightforward application of the Brown case, my primary goal here today is just to make myself available for this court's questions. I was not planning on belaboring each of the 10-plus Brown factors, although I would be happy to discuss any of them. For many of those factors, however, it's sufficient to say that there simply is no information in the record for this court to review. Those factors include the length of continuance necessary, prejudice to the prosecution, inconvenience to witnesses, the impact on the court's docket as of December of 2010, and the victim's position also as of December of 2010.
Well, Mr. Evans, I know you said that you don't want to dwell on the factors, but given the polar opposite views, or almost polar opposite views, expressed by you and Ms. Grundy in your supplemental briefs, maybe it would be helpful if you would respond to some of the points that she makes, asserting that there is sufficient information in the record with regard to many of the Brown factors.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the two factors that I was planning to focus on today were the two that on which this court placed primary reliance in its original decision in this case, Mr. Almanza's apparent motive for attaining private counsel and private counsel's availability. Regarding Mr. Almanza's apparent motive, this court found that the circumstances suggested that they were dilatory or contrived. But in light of Brown, that finding does not allow for an affirmance. Brown made clear that mere suggestions in the record are not sufficient to find that a particular one of the 10 factors has been addressed. The record in Brown itself contained suggestions that the defendant was not seeking to obtain counsel for dilatory reasons, including private counsel's statement to that effect.
But counsel, let me do this. Sorry to interrupt, but to follow up on what my colleague just asked you, because your views are so different with regard to the factors, can you walk through them one by one so we can sort of see how you come out and ask you questions about them if they're different than what your counterpart says about them, for instance?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And if it's okay with Your Honor, I will start with the two I was initially planning to address and then okay. Continue through the list as I have time to do so. In Brown, the Supreme Court specifically noted the trial court did not make findings on the record concerning whether the Brown defendant was seeking continuance for dilatory motives. And it was that need for specific findings on the record that was one of the reasons that the Supreme Court found that a remand was required. And that's exactly what happened here. Here, as the answer brief readily admitted, there were no specific findings by the trial court on this issue.
And counsel, it's my understanding that you're asking for a remand so that the trial can make those additional findings. But given the passage of time and the fact that we're dealing with, now what is a fairly dated case, how is the trial court going to be in any different position than we would, looking at the record as it exists, to make those findings?
Well, Your Honor, I think there are two different answers to that. The first one is that the way this case was postured, when the final continuance was made, Mr. Almanza had made repeated requests to replace his appointed public defender. And all of the information that this court has, everything on the record about what steps were taken to effect that replacement or the availability of that particular private counsel, all of that information came from the very attorney that Mr. Almanza was trying to replace. And in fact, at that final hearing in December, the public defender even told the district court, listen, I have advised Mr. Almanza that at this point, the matter of a continuance is between him and the court. And at that point, the court made no inquiry whatsoever of Mr. Almanza as to any of these things. And I think that it's clear from Arguello, it's clear from Apodaca, it's clear in Green, the Illinois case that's cited in the briefs, and it's also clear in Brown that when presented with that type of situation, the court has a duty to inquire of Mr. Almanza himself, not the attorney that he's trying to replace. Both this court and the Supreme Court criticized the trial court in Brown for not asking the right questions relevant to the inquiry.
Mr. Evans, I'm sorry, go ahead and finish what you're saying.
I mean, in terms of where Mr. Almanza had been at that point and what his family had done to obtain private counsel, I would assume, I'm an appellate practitioner, so somewhat speculative, but I'm assuming that on remand, he would pursue affidavits, if not a subpoena, from the Mr. Smith in California to get that information. But the other answer to your question, Judge Fox, is that it really doesn't make any difference because, as the Brown dissent pointed out, these difficulties are going to exist. And the majority writing Brown knew that they were going to exist because all of these things were pointed out by the dissent. But that doesn't change the outcome of Brown, which is obviously binding upon this court.
Mr. Evans, I don't want to sidetrack you from following Judge Roman's request to go through all the factors, but I just wanted to ask you with regard to Mr. Smith, is there any information in the record either as to whether he was licensed to practice in Colorado or in the alternative whether Mr. Almanza had made any efforts to associate with a Colorado attorney?
I do not believe that that information is in the record. I know that there's kind of speculation on the part of the district court and on the part of the public defender that Mr. Smith may not have been licensed to practice and would need to seek pro hac vice admission here. However, I don't think that there's anything more definite than that in the record.
Okay, thank you. You may continue answering Judge Roman's question now.
Thank you, Your Honor. And Judge Roman, to move on to the next factor, the availability of chosen counsel. In this court's original opinion, it found that the California attorney's lack of involvement supported denying a continuance. But for similar reasons, I mean, that finding is not controlling in light of Brown. Brown illustrates that there's no reason to believe that Mr. Almanza's appointed public defender would have had any idea of what steps Mr. Almanza's family had taken to retain this attorney, nor his availability. Indeed, Mr. Brown's public defender had absolutely no idea that her client was attempting to retain private counsel until that individual entered an appearance. And when that individual showed up, he explained that he didn't want to enter an appearance until he had been officially retained. So there's just no information about the availability of this person in the record, and that's what the trial court should have obtained from Mr. Almanza. So moving on to the rest of the factors addressed in Brown, regarding the length of a continuance necessary, one of the reasons for a remand in Brown was that the Supreme Court specifically noted that the trial court did not ask the question regarding how long the continuance would be necessary. That question was also not asked here. So this case is directly equivalent to Brown, I guess. The potential prejudice to the prosecution. In Brown, the record contained no information regarding prejudice to the prosecution other than the fact that the prosecutor objected to a continuance. And that's exactly what we have here. The prosecutor did object, but the prosecutor never asserted any sort of specific prejudice. And there's plenty of case law pointed out in the briefs indicating that where there's nothing in the record to show specific prejudice to the prosecution, then that's not something that weighs against the defendant. And that's, I would point this court toward Espinoza, is the one Colorado case that's 575 P second 851 at 853, and then Courts and Gale are both out-of-state cases standing for the same proposition. Regarding the inconvenience to witnesses, in Brown, the when the court was denying the continuance at issue there, it noted that there had been several witnesses subpoenaed for that particular case. Obviously, there were witnesses subpoenaed in this case as well. But in both cases, there's no indication that those witnesses would have been specifically inconvenienced by a continuance. Now, the Attorney General has pointed out that, you know, the people in this case did have some problems with witnesses who were being a little squirrely in terms of showing up on their subpoena dates, but there's no indication that they would have been any more or less squirrely had there been another continuance granted. And to the extent that, you know, many of the state's key witnesses here ended up getting up on the stand and claiming not to remember any of the events in question, it's not as though they would have remembered any more than nothing had this case occurred months later. So again, there's no showing here whatsoever regarding the inconvenience to witnesses. In terms of the age of the case, the sixth Brown factor, in Brown, I know that in the briefs there was some discussion about that case only having been in the judicial system for 10 months, but if you look at the Brown decision, the events that gave rise to the case, the actual crimes, occurred in March of 2004, and the request for a continuance at issue in that case was in February of 2006, so that's a span of almost 2 years. Whereas here, the request for a continuance is less than 16 months after the victim was killed. So, you know, if anything, the age of the case would weigh more in Mr. Almanza's favor in terms of granting a continuance than it weighed in Brown. Regarding the number of continuances, also number of continuances already granted. In Brown, the requested continuance had been the fourth, and it appeared that there was that one of those was specifically chargeable to the defense. Here, this would have been the third continuance, with one of those prior two continuances chargeable to the prosecution, primarily for discovery issues, and one of them for purposes of retaining counsel. So, I mean, again, I don't know that this case is meaningfully distinguishable from Brown in that respect. Your Honor, I notice I'm down to 2 minutes and 45 seconds here. Can I reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal, or would you like me to continue going through the factors?
No, that's fine with me.
Okay.
So you may reserve the rest of your time then.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Erin Grundy, registration number 41271, and I represent the people. In this case, the trial court properly denied the defendant's motion for continuance, and the record is substantially developed for this court to review. Counsel, let me ask you about that record. Here we have a very, very limited record. We're talking about, I mean, effectively 5 pages, maybe 4, actually, of, you know, substantively addressing this issue. On this record, how in the world can we decipher the applicability of those 11 factors? Again, when at the time that the trial court made its findings, it was only aware of 3 factors that applied. Now it has 11 factors. So wouldn't we be doing nothing better than speculating, you know, and guessing at how the trial court might come out on the rest of the factors? So why shouldn't we remand?
Your Honor, that's an interesting point, and it goes to a matter of findings versus factors. So certainly the findings of the trial court at the actual time it denied the continuance would be insufficient. Yet if we look at these factors, Brown doesn't limit this court to reviewing just the trial court's order. Brown's language is prospective. It guides trial courts in the future for the 11 factors that they should consider in denying future motions for a continuance. It gives us a lens for reviewing this case, but Brown certainly couldn't have anticipated that a trial court deciding this case prior to this Court of Appeals even deciding Brown would somehow have anticipated the 11-factor test that the Supreme Court acknowledged no court anywhere had ever adopted. So there's no expectation that trial court should have actually made a particular litany of 11-factor findings. Instead, we look to the record as a whole to see whether those factors are in fact supported.
Ms. Grundy, how is that, what you're saying, consistent with what the majority actually decided in Brown? Because there, similarly, the court applied a new test and said, well, we're not going to look at the record, or there's insufficient information in the record, so we're going to remand it to the trial court to make additional findings.
Your Honor, in Brown, the Supreme Court specifically looks at whether there was sufficient information to support the trial court's decision, ultimately whether the record was substantially developed, and they point to four particular factors that Brown was not developed in. Those were how long counsel would need to prepare, the impact on the court's docket, inconvenience to witnesses, and the victim's position. In this case, each of those four factors is developed.
Let's take the first one. I mean, I don't know that our record tells us how long the California attorney needed to be ready to proceed. In fact, we just don't know.
Yes,
we never heard from him.
And Your Honor, in this case, that is a very important point, because the request for a continuance, the length of preparation, was essentially indefinite. In Brown, we had an attorney who had physically appeared, who'd entered an appearance, who'd hired an investigator, and who indicated, I need time to review discovery, and at that point, I will be prepared.
You that call it indefinite. I call it unknown. I mean, we just don't know. And so why not a remand so we can find out what the attorney has to say about when he would have been ready?
Yes, Your Honor, that could be appropriate in some cases. In this case, I believe that the totality of the circumstances before the court demonstrate that this attorney was never going to be retained. He'd had more than 6 months to do it and made zero progress. The $7,000 that had been paid, there is no indication that the family would have ever been able to come up with the indefinite amount of money that would have been necessary to retain Mr. Smith.
Well, isn't that part of the problem, Ms. Grundy? I mean, when you just described it as indefinite amount of money, if Mr. Almanza and his family had paid $7,000, do we know if the additional amount was $1,000 or $10,000?
No, Your Honor. What we do know is that this is a first-degree murder case with complicated technical expertise in which the attorney had done absolutely nothing to prepare. We also know from the public defender's motion, which is contained in Volume 1, page 106 of the record, that the attorney was apparently not licensed in Colorado because he was trying to find Colorado counsel to assist in representation. So not only do we have an unlicensed attorney who has never shown up, but we also have someone who has demonstrated no ability to actually retain this counsel. Sixth Amendment does not guarantee indefinite continuances in hopes that your financial position will change.
Ms. Grundy, the record, or the briefs at least, say that, that Mr. Smith in California apparently had previously represented Mr. Almanza.
Yes, Your Honor. And we also know that Mr. Almanza has substantial connections to California in that he'd been arrested in California in this case. We don't know whether Mr. Smith had ever represented Mr. Almanza in California or in Colorado.
Okay.
So that is up to speculation. Now, certainly, there is a record before this court to review. While it's not the 11-factor finding that we hope to see in future cases, that we hope trial courts will take from Brown and make these findings in the future, there is a record for this court to review, and in fact, this court has already done so in analyzing the four-factor test that had previously come out of this court. This court already determined that the defendant's motion was dilatory, in part based on the fact that the length of gap and that no one had ever actually appeared, that Mr. Smith had not contacted the public defender, had not contacted the prosecutor, had not requested any type of discovery, so certainly hadn't begun reviewing it, that Mr. Smith never appeared, despite the defendant's representation at the June 29th hearing that he'd purchased a plane ticket and would appear so. So in this case, we have a dilatory motive, which this court has already determined the record was sufficient to review for that factor.
So Ms. Grundy, how mechanical is the rule that we're dealing with here with as it regards the 11 factors? There's mandatory language used by the majority, the dissent criticizes them because they're using mandatory language and it looks mechanical. What are we stuck with at this point?
Your Honor, that's an interesting question, and I think we should look at it under two classes of cases. The first will be cases that were tried and the continuance was requested after Brown. There we certainly hope to see further developed. Now, Brown acknowledges that not every factor may actually implicate every case. One of those good factors may be victim's position. If it's not a case that implicates the BRA, there's certainly no responsibility to note the victim's position in that case. So in that class of cases, we hope that the factors applicable would be developed. Not every factor may apply to every case, And some factors may be so overwhelming. Perhaps we're 5 years out from trial, or 5 years out from the facts, and the court can acknowledge that this case needs to go. We've had 17 continuances. We're 5 years out. There is no counterbalancing left in this case.
So you believe that Brown separates two kinds of classes of cases, the ones that were decided before Brown, which is to be applied and analyzed one way, and the ones that are decided after Brown, which then have to become more mechanical?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court doesn't answer that question. They've left it to you to decide how this will be applied. So they've looked at at Brown itself and found this case did not have a sufficiently developed record. So Brown and Mr. Almanza's case bring us to that second class of cases, those cases that were on direct appeal or at least tried after, or at least tried prior to the Brown decision coming out, where we can't expect an 11-factor finding from the trial courts, but we know what factors to look at to see whether the trial court's decision is supported by the record. So we use Brown as a lens. We look at those 11 factors and determine whether there's sufficient information to support it. There may be some cases where a trial court's decision simply has no record support, and reversal may be the appropriate remedy. We look at some cases where the trial court's finding may have 9 of the factors. Maybe the VRA doesn't apply, so effectively we have all 10. So there may be some cases where we have sufficient findings. Others, like Brown, where we don't. So it's a question of which category of cases does this case fall into.
And so what's the harm? I mean, if we don't reverse, but we just remand again to build a better record.
Your Honor, your point is well taken that 5 years out, it's hard to say what type of record could be constructed, especially in this case where we're rapidly approaching the mandatory release date for the defendant. 5 years out, we won't necessarily be able to go back and obtain the victim's position at the time. We don't know what their position would have been on that day. 5 years out, we may not be able to go back and obtain the impact it would have had on the court's docket, because we don't know what other cases would have happened. We may know some of the settings, but even that, based on continuances, based on cases being settled, we don't know what the impact on the court's docket would have been 5 years ago. What we do have is the record in this case. What we do have is the record in this case in which the court explained that it would have been a challenge to reschedule this murder case. We have that particular finding that was contemporaneous. And we have this court's prior decision that looked at that finding and noted the inherent difficulties in rescheduling a first-degree homicide case. Certainly not an easy one to fit in on a court's docket in a busy district court.
Ms. Grundy, I'd like to ask you a question about the wild card factor, factor number 11, and I hope to ask Mr. Evans the same question. Even though Mr. Almanza did not have his counsel of choice when he went to trial, he was acquitted on the most serious charge against him, which was first degree murder, and convicted of a lesser non-included offense. Do those facts have any bearing on the analysis of whether he was denied his right to counsel of choice in your view?
Your Honor, that's an interesting question. It certainly was a well-tried case for Mr. Almanza, and there's certainly no dispute that the public defender was ready, as he indicated he was ready and prepared to try the case. Did a fantastic job. The defendant was also acquitted of the lesser included offense of second-degree murder. But in this case, it's a question of what standard of... I argue that it should be considered a standard of reversal. What standard of reversal applies? So first, if we look to abuse of discretion, did the trial court abuse its discretion? The people contend the answer in this case is no. The trial court's finding is supported, and the record, there was substantial support. Then the second question is, are we in a harmless case or are we in a structural case? And the threshold question to that is, if the trial court abused its discretion, did that abuse of discretion actually deprive the defendant of the protections conferred by the Sixth Amendment? In effect, was he actually deprived his right to choice of counsel? The answer here is no, because he had no demonstrated ability to retain choice of counsel, so we're not in a structural category of cases. If that puts us into the harmless category of cases, which it would probably be a constitutional harmless, as there's certainly no dispute that this was a preserved question before the court, then the acquittal may be a factor in that case. But obviously that's about four steps down the line. The first question for this court is going to be, did the did the trial court abuse its discretion in denying the motion for continuance? And is there sufficient information in the record for this court to make that finding? Here, there is sufficient information. As I noted in the supplemental brief, the 11 factors are supported by the record. While the length of continuance may not be determined, that weighs against the defendant because there was no demonstrated ability to actually retain Mr. Smith, that Mr. Smith would ever in fact be admitted and would ever show up. After one continuance had been granted, in part for the defendant to retain Mr. Smith had still done nothing. We'd made no progress in the case. We see that it was very difficult. As Mr. Evans noted, witnesses testified, "I don't remember anything." Certainly would have been exacerbated. We know that some witnesses had to be actually issued warrants because they were being so uncooperative. The trouble with witnesses, the trouble to the prosecution, and the delay on the court's docket all weighed against a continuance in this case. Here, the record was sufficiently developed, and nothing in Brown demands that every case be remanded. Instead, this court should only remand those cases where the record as a whole cannot support the trial court's findings. Therefore, the people respectfully request that this court affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you, Ms. Grundy.
There are 2 points that I'd like to respond to regarding the Attorney General's characterization of Brown, and then 2 points regarding the characterization of the facts in this case. First, the Attorney General characterizes Brown as looking at findings versus factors and, you know, permitting this court to divine from the record things that weren't necessarily addressed by the district court. But I think that the actual disposition in the Brown case refutes that. I mean, for many of the factors listed by the court, there was evidence in the record in Brown, but in many instances, because the court did not specifically address that and make a finding about how that weighed regarding the request for a continuance, that's why a remand was required. Second, counsel noted that, or said that Brown acknowledges that not every factor need apply in every case. In response to that, I'd simply quote Justice Marquez, stating that the majority adopts a mechanical test that requires trial courts to consider and make a sufficient record with respect to a list of 10 or more factors, regardless of whether those factors are even relevant in the particular case. So my reading of the case is not a novel one. Regarding the facts here, the Attorney General continues to assert that Mr. Almanza was acting with dilatory motives. And I'd just like to point out to the court, because I don't think I emphasized this enough in the briefs, that when the district court was actually denying Mr. Almanza's request, it said, "I don't know anything about the attorney. The public defender has indicated that your family is interested in hiring. I can't evaluate the credentials of the attorney, but I can tell you your case is getting old and you have a very good public defender." And the court addressed this. The court acknowledged the fact that this was a person that his family was interested in hiring and did not make the finding that he was doing so with any sort of dilatory motive. Nobody has suggested that. Finally, the $7,000 that had been paid, that was new information at that last hearing that had not been brought out before. So that illustrates that there was some form of progress being made toward retaining this attorney. And in those circumstances, the court had a duty to ask. So Brown is directly on point. At this point, all we're asking is a faithful application of Brown and a remand to the district court to allow Mr. Almanza to develop the record.
Mr. Evans, your time is up, but I would like you to answer the same question that I posed to Ms. Grundy about whether Mr. Almanza's acquittal on the first degree murder charges against him has any bearing on our analysis here.
And Your Honor, I appreciate the time to do so, and respectfully, no, it doesn't. Mr. Almanza still has a felony conviction on his record for participating in the killing of another human being, and one of the sort of niche areas of practice that I've developed within the public defender's office is acknowledging and dealing with the myriad consequences that come with having any form of felony conviction on a record. And I would direct this court to the public defender's website. There's a document posted on the public website called The Consequences of Conviction that lists all of the multitude of consequences that inure with having any felony on your record. So I don't think that the fact that Mr. Almanza was acquitted of first-degree murder has any bearing on whether he could have benefited from the representation of this attorney with whom he had a previously established relationship.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Grundy, again. Thank you, Mr. Evans. We appreciate your argument. This case illustrates that not only are there many shades of gray sometimes, but many shades of brown. So we appreciate your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That.